From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the chess master who defeated the computer. We talk with world champion Garry Kasparov. Also, we talk about golf with a man better known for his novels than his swing. John Updike's new book collects his fiction and nonfiction writing about the game. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Margaret Atwood's first crime novel, Alias Grace. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Record cold temperatures and ice are blamed for at least 26 deaths, ranging from Minnesota south to Texas. Thousands of people are still without power. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports.
An unusual ice storm snarled air and road traffic from Texas north to Missouri. Icy roads are blamed for at least 24 deaths. Conditions are not normally this bad this early in the winter weather season. But an extremely frigid blast of Arctic air pushed south from Canada, driving temperatures well below zero in the northern plain states, and is responsible for the ice as far south as Texas. It's clear but very cold across most of the Midwest, and conditions are not expected to moderate until after Thanksgiving. Temperatures in the region are forecast to remain 15 to 20 degrees below normal until then, and climatologists warn this could be one of the coldest winters on record in the Midwest. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran reporting.
The release of an American detained in North Korea has hit a snag. U.S. officials say the release of Evan Hunziker has run into complications. New Mexico Congressman Bill Richardson was supposed to bring Hunziker to Japan today, but Hunziker's father says Richardson isn't sure the release is coming off as planned. A U.S. military spokesman in Japan says the release is being delayed until tomorrow, at least. Officials won't say what's going on. Hunziker was arrested and charged with spying when he crossed into North Korea from China in August. Hunziker's relatives say he probably crossed the border to try to convert North Koreans to Christianity. President and Mrs. Clinton are returning to the United States after completing their 12-day trip to Asia, where they attended the APEC conference in Manila. Mr. Clinton also used the trip to pay a courtesy call on Thailand. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports from Bangkok.
From Australia to Manila to Bangkok, President Clinton has been delivering much the same message. The U.S. is committed to an ongoing leadership role in the Asia-Pacific, and it encourages the region's pursuit of democracy and economic development. The president talked about that again on the last stop of his tour, Bangkok. He addressed the people of Thailand from the country's most prestigious school, Chulalongkorn University. The university used the occasion to bestow an honorary economics degree on the American head of state. The president and Mrs. Clinton now return to Washington just in time for the Thanksgiving holiday. I'm Vicky O'Hara with the president in Bangkok.
A private business research group says the nation's consumer confidence remained steady in November. The conference board's consumer confidence index remained unchanged at 107.3, but its measure of current business conditions rose to its highest level in 7 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 27.5 points to 6,520. This is NPR. Federal regulators are expected to move toward lowering international telephone rates. The Federal Communications Commission is expected to adopt an order intended to make international phone rates more closely reflect the actual cost of making such a call. Officials say the order will free U.S. firms to negotiate with foreign carriers, leading to lower rates for consumers. Currently, companies must rely on government tariff agreements. The FCC estimates U.S. consumers pay, on the average, 99 cents a minute for international calls. Regulators say, based on actual costs, that should only be about 50 cents a minute, and there is no guarantee any cut in the fees would be passed on to the consumer. Federal officials say all of the nation's moving railroad bridges will be inspected by the end of the year. This follows a derailment over the weekend. Gavin Sutton of member station WBGO reports.
Some 200 moving bridges serve U.S. railroads. The move to inspect them comes after Saturday's derailment of an Amtrak passenger and mail train in northern New Jersey. Inspectors believe the train left the tracks because of improper rail alignment. An investigation revealed cracked and broken steel plates known as sidebars. The accident left 36 people injured and crippled Northeast Corridor traffic. Full service resumed Monday but was delayed as Amtrak and commuter trains crept through the accident scene. Officials announced this morning that normal service had resumed. The Federal Railroad Administration plans to check the nation's moving bridges for misalignments, cracks, and strains. It plans to have the inspections completed by December 31st. For National Public Radio, I'm Gavin Sutton in Newark.
Tropical storm Marco has been downgraded to a tropical depression and is expected to go on dissipating. The weather system is about 140 miles south-southeast of the western tip of Cuba. At one point, Marco was a hurricane but was downgraded to a tropical depression over the weekend. Yesterday, it grew back into a tropical storm before beginning to lose strength again. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. World chess champion Garry Kasparov bolstered the human ego when he triumphed earlier this year in a match with Deep Blue, an IBM computer. Kasparov became the Soviet chess champion at age 18. In 1985, at the age of 22, he defeated Anatoly Karpov to become the youngest world champion in history. Kasparov grew up in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. The Soviet authorities considered his success to be great PR, until he became an outspoken critic of communism. He's now active in Russia's political life and campaigned for Russian President Yeltsin's re-election. Now he has a new talking chess game called Talking Coach, which is designed to be both a coach and a worthy opponent. I asked him about his match against the computer Deep Blue. What was the computer's approach to analyzing the game?
Deep Blue was never designed as a chess computer. In fact, Deep Blue emerged from IBM research of parallel processors. And they recognized by mid-80s, probably late-80s, that chess could give them unique opportunity to try to solve this very important problem in the computing industry, which is to force parallel processors talk to each other without wasting a lot of energy by just doubling the same results. Deep Blue's way of playing, Deep Blue style, if you call it, it's quite simple and primitive. You know, it calculates, calculates, and calculates. It's a brute force of calculation. But we faced, in fact, I had to face in last February, a phenomenon when quantity was translated into a real quality jump, because suddenly we discovered that on these numbers, and Deep Blue could make, per average, 100 million positions per second, which is a big number, even for the beginners, for chess fans, or for just some for the general public and for professional players. With these numbers, I realized that Deep Blue was able to solve some positional problems because it saw so deep and it could avoid some short-term positional mistakes. I'm not talking, of course, about tactics. You know, it's so sharp and so precise. Now they are working very hard to get some chess knowledge into the machine to make this machine more to make it fit for a real chess challenge. And in fact, we'll face very soon a super powerful version of Deep Blue, and next May, when I play it again, it will not be easy at all.
Now, how does computer logic differ from human logic in playing chess?
I think the biggest difference between human player and computer is flexibility. Because when we play chess, we cannot calculate everything to the very end. We have to make selection of the move based on some very subjective factors. We have to evaluate the position. We have to look three, four, five moves ahead as far as we can and to find out from our perspectives what could be the net result of different route we're going to take. There are many, many factors that we have to take into account. But I know, and all my human opponents, they know that these factors, even some of them are dominant, in many positions can lose their importance. That's why we can easily reshuffle these factors, these priorities, and we are evaluating position using our intuition rather than a pure mathematical calculation. Now, when computer is doing the same exercise, and it just it calculates a line, and it goes to the end of the line, and it has to evaluate the final position, computer has a set of priorities built up by the programmers. And this is a fixed set of priorities. That's important to understand. It's if number one priority is a pawn structure, number two is the position of the king, I mean safety of the king, it will always be number one and number two, even if these factors are less important in the in a very special position that could arise in the middle of the complicated line. That's why computer is not able to reshuffle these priorities. And the moment you realize the way machine thinks, the way machine makes decisions, machine is very vulnerable to your strategy, because I can change my strategy. I can shift from one strategic route to another. Machine is not capable of doing so. Also, during the match, the six games match, programmers, they don't have any time to change these priorities. That's why it will take them 2, 3, 4, 5 months in the lab when they can learn the lessons of the previous match and then to change the machine to set up new priorities. But, you know, at the end of the day, the flexibility is a big, big problem for the machine.
So do you feel that you were able to analyze the computer's thinking and then outsmart it?
Yes, I was very lucky that the first two games, you know, I lost game one and I won game two. It meant the first two games ended with an even score. And these two games gave me invaluable information about the way machine was operating. And at the end of game two, I knew more or less correctly what was the general approach of the machine. And that's why I was able to build my strategy based on these assumptions. And at the end of the match, it was proven that my assumptions were absolutely correct. I felt at what point Deep Blue would be very stubborn and it would not be able to shift from one route to another.
Did you feel like you were representing mankind against machine, and that if you lost, it would be a defeat for mankind, and if you won, a triumph for the human being?
I don't think we can talk about the triumph, because the machines are getting better and better. That's why even if,
right.
if
the battle's not over yet.
Yeah, exactly. If it's a triumph, it's very temporarily. But the defeat could be quite disastrous, and that's why the pressure on my shoulders, the psychological pressure was much higher than a normal chess event, because when I play a world championship match, I can lose my title, which is important for myself. It's important for my relatives, my friends, some time is important for chess, but playing machine, I represented a very, very, I wouldn't say the whole mankind, but definitely many, many people that believe that human's integrity and human superiority was in danger.
Okay, so here you have all the psychological pressure on you, even more pressure than when you're defending your title against another person, and yet you can't psych out a machine in the way you can psych out an opponent. You can't look at the machine and expect to intimidate them with your look. You can't analyze the computer's face and see where are their vulnerabilities today.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, any outside psychological factors working against me, because machine doesn't tire, machine doesn't care about the weather, about the noisy public, about the press, you know, about just any other factor will work against me, because I'm a human being and I'm exposed to some disturbances during the event. But as I said already, machine is not flexible. And again, the moment I know the characteristics of my opponent, I feel very comfortable, very confident, because I know this opponent now, it's like an open book for me. When I have a human opponent, I will never enjoy the same privilege. The question is whether I will be able in next May to do the same within the first two games. I mean, just to get all information from these games, to analyze that and to make a new portrait of my opponent. Because the disadvantage of the first match and also the second one, that I do not have access to any game played by Deep Blue. That's why, you know, I have to prepare myself for the opponent without any available information.
Is it ever frustrating to play against a computer that doesn't sweat and it doesn't show any kind of crack emotionally? And if you're frustrated, I mean, what are you going to do? You're just staring at this implacable object.
No, if I'm frustrated, I will lose. You know,
right. Is that true? Frustration and,
no,
and it's all over?
Frustration is the first step because under this pressure, you can't afford to be frustrated. It just you lose control for a second. And with a human being, you can hope for, you know, opponent's mistake.
Right.
It could be a gesture of goodwill. And in fact, the opponent also could crack under pressure. If you do a mistake with a machine, there's no mercy. That's why the difference between a game against a machine is that you can lose your concentration. And the moment you're frustrated, your concentration will be lost for sure.
Now, what do you do in a chess match to keep up your concentration and to prevent frustration or any other emotion from interfering with your game?
No, it's absolutely impossible to keep frustration out of you for the whole match. I do my best, but even in a match against Deep Blue, I was frustrated a couple of times. And in game four, for instance, when I was a crack in the computer and just it didn't work for about 15 minutes and just they lost the signal and whatsoever. And I was very nervous. It's obvious frustration. And then I immediately made one mistake, another mistake, and I was very, very close losing again. Luckily, my position was quite good before it happened. That's why I was able to defend that. But it was very, very unpleasant. And I felt pretty bad. And I mean, I learned that whatsoever, I have to keep my concentration and just ignore what's going around. I think it's doable, yes, to be quiet. If you can concentrate on your opponent, you know, I try to imagine that it's an opponent with some qualities. You know, it could be human being, it could be machine, but it's just an opponent. And this opponent has such and such and such characteristics. And as I have to take this or that strategic route to play the game because that will be the best and the most annoying for my opponent. And trying to isolate myself from the nature, physical nature of the opponent, that helps.
Garry Kasparov is my guest, world chess champion. Let's take a short break and then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with world chess champion Garry Kasparov. And now he has a new chess game that's called Talking Coach, and it's a computerized chess game that actually gives you advice as you play. Now, how did you learn to play?
I was watching my parents playing and or trying to solve a problem, and I was very curious about this mysterious game, and I learned from my father at age 5 and a half.
Your father died when you were 7.
Yeah.
How did that change your life as a young boy and also as someone who is interested in chess?
I can hardly recall any memories of that time.
Mm-hmm.
It was over a quarter century ago.
Right.
And I didn't memorize well my relationship with my father because as a child, you're not concentrating very much on something that always was you. And you know, these relations, it was just a part of my normal life, and suddenly he's gone. And, I mean, I was very lucky to have a mother that spent whole of her life just working for my success. And that's why, you know, it was probably a bit one-sided because I didn't have a father, but my mother created an atmosphere where I could grow as a proper person.
So she already loved the game and played it well.
No, she was a very random player, but she knew that I had a talent, and she did everything to help me to grow as a chess player and also to be a well-educated person.
What did you like about chess as a child?
I think as a child I loved playing chess. I was winning very often, and that's also a good factor. But it's a strange relation that I can hardly describe. I felt very good playing chess. I felt that it's something that is built for me, or I'm built for that. At very early age, 13 to 14, I knew it would be my profession and I could be very, very successful, even to be a potential world champion.
Now, when you were young and you were starting to beat adults, how did they react?
Some of them didn't react friendly because I was very young to beat the adults. And today it's a quite normal when you see 12 or 13 year old kid beating, you know, an adult player. But at the time when I started playing chess, it was quite unusual. And I can recall certain moments when they expressed openly their frustration by losing to a kid. But, you know, it went away very soon because I got my reputation. And in fact, the playing adults moved me to adult world too early. And that's probably one of the regrets that I have about my childhood, because I had to stay in a different atmosphere and some of the joys of childhood were lost.
Is there an age that's considered to be the prime for a chess player?
50 years ago, you know, 40 years ago, the conventional wisdom was that 35 to 40 years, that's a prime time for the chess player. Today, it sounds very funny because most of the top chess players are under 30. And I think it's absolutely normal because we have a new type of the game. It's a professional game. It takes more time. You have to study a lot. And it's just, if you don't pay enough attention, you'll be out of the loop. And also, it requires too much energy, and the pressure on the players is bigger than before, and that explains why younger players are so successful.
How important and how popular was chess in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan, where you grew up?
Chess was a very important part of the Soviet Union, all parts of the Soviet Union. I think there were a few reasons. Maybe it has to do something with the culture, but the main reason was that the Soviet regime always treated chess as a super important ideological weapon to prove the superiority of the Soviet communist regime over decadent West. And that's why chess from late 20s in the Soviet Union, chess was seen by party officials as an important game, and they always paid a great deal of attention. That's why the chess players, they got state support, and by playing chess on a good level, by playing chess for national team, you could make a decent living and you could get certain independence from the Communist Party. And I think that's because of the reason I just described. Many parents considered chess, other sports, music, ballet, as one of the few opportunities that they were open for their kids. And that's why chess, among other things I described, was very popular. And I don't think that the number of talented kids in United States or in France is lower than in Russia. But there are too many other options for kids in the Western countries, and chess was not a prestigious one. That's why the Soviet Union exploited maximum of its chess potential, while other countries never had the same attitude toward the game.
When did you realize that if you got really good at chess, that the Soviet Union would use you as an ideological weapon in this Cold War?
Yeah, but I was very happy about that because I wanted to be the world champion. You know, I was not a big hero, you know, fighting for the human rights. I had a very modest goal for, you know, for a big ideological war, but for myself, it was crucial. You know, I wanted to be number one in the world. I felt I had a good chance, and I realized very soon that in order to avoid troubles that I had in the Soviet Union, because I'm not an ethnic Russian, and I had to fight Anatoly Karpov, who was an ethnic Russian and a darling of the system, I had to be loyal to the communist regime. I mean, just without making too much noise. In fact, I couldn't avoid making noise because I'm quite rebellion by my nature. But still, I was trying very hard, and I before 85, I behaved myself. I couldn't avoid all the troubles, but only after I won the title, I was able to demonstrate my independence very openly.
So you think that the Soviet government preferred the person who you got the title from, Karpov, because he was an ethnic Russian and you were not, you were Azerbaijani?
No, I'm half Armenian, half Jewish.
Half Armenian, half Jewish,
which is probably not a very good thing as well for Russia.
But absolutely.
No, I think it's, you know, the ethnical factor was important, but more important was that I never, you know, I couldn't show that the real ties with the regime. You know, they felt that I'm not a very disciplined member of the community, and Karpov represented them very well because he was ready, and he indicated that at a young age, and he continued to play under the rules that they established. And I always tried to break the rules, and despite my hard attempts to be a good boy, they felt that it would be over as soon as I won the title.
What rules did you break?
Well, no, you have to respect the rules that everything happened in the Soviet Union was an internal matter. You couldn't go to foreign journalists. You couldn't make the stories a property of the rest of the world. And when they closed, my first match was Karpov in 85, you know, I made big statements, which were nothing more than, you know, complain about the injustice in chess. But I complained to the rest of the world, you know, that's not good. And the whole style of my lifestyle, my behavior, I mean, was very much against these very strict rules imposed on important personalities in the Soviet Union.
World chess champion Garry Kasparov. He now has a new talking chess game called Talking Coach. Kasparov will be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with world chess champion Garry Kasparov. Also, a great writer who's had trouble perfecting his swing, we talk with John Updike about his new book, Golf Dreams. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Margaret Atwood's new true crime novel, Alias Grace. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with world chess champion Garry Kasparov. He became the youngest world champion in 1985 at the age of 22. Earlier this year, in a grueling match, he defeated the IBM computer Deep Blue. Kasparov grew up in the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan and now lives in Russia. You said before that you think one of the reasons why chess had been so important in the Soviet Union was because it was an ideological weapon in the Cold War. It was a way to prove, the Soviet people are so smart and they're the best at chess. Now that the Cold War is over, do you think that chess will remain as important as it was in the past?
Oh, it's obviously losing its importance.
It is?
Yeah, because the government doesn't pay anymore. The Russian Chess Federation should live on its own. Also, chess is not a part of the IOC, International Olympic Committee, and that's why we're not represented. Chess is not represented on the big Olympic Games, and that's why it's in the eyes of the sport officials, it has less importance, because we have something, separate events, and they're less prestigious than the big Olympics that just recently took place in Atlanta. Clearly, the Russian chess is suffering a setback, but we had a very good tradition. We still have many young players, and Russia today is still the dominant and the strongest chess country in the world. But for the future, I have some worries because the number of the chess tournaments in Russia, it's less than it has to be for a country of such chess importance.
You're very active in Russian politics, and you worked actively.
I was.
What? Well, you worked actively for Yeltsin's re-election. Has something changed since then?
I was quite active in Russian politics, in the Soviet politics in the late 80s, early 90s, then in Russian politics in 93, now in 96. I didn't have any special political aspirations, but I believe that a person of my importance and, a world champion in Russia is chess champion is more than just a simple world champion. It's kind of a symbol of the country. And I felt I couldn't be silent. I had to tell people about my views, my opinions, and that would help them to make their own choice. And I participated in the political life at the moments of the crucial importance, as at the moment of the collapse of the Soviet Union and then this fight between President Yeltsin and the parliament. And, of course, I helped Mr. Yeltsin to be reelected, not because I supported very much Mr. Yeltsin's policies, but we had a very simple choice, either the current government or the communist comeback. And I believed, and I still believe, that if communists had a chance to take over Kremlin, that would be a disaster for the country. And I did my best, traveling throughout the country, meeting people, and telling them that we'd better stick with Mr. Yeltsin.
There's been a lot of speculation about your own political aspirations. Do you have any?
Not yet. I'm used to study carefully my chances in every field, and I knew, as I said, at age 13 or 14, I would be a potential world champion. It takes some time for me to understand what I want to accomplish in politics, if I want to move in, and what are my chances. And obviously now I'm occupied with chess, with other chess activities. We have greater chances to build a website, chess website with IBM. I'm working on many things related to chess. I have some business aspirations. And I decided just to put these political ideas aside for a while, and I will reevaluate these chances by the end of this century, because I still believe there are too many things I have to accomplish before I move to active politics, which prevents you from doing anything else.
What do you think of chess as a spectator sport?
I think it has some hidden potential. I think it's underestimated, because chess always had a problem to find its box. We couldn't even describe chess, whether it's a sport, and some countries deny that. In many countries, it's not recognized as a sport. It's kind of science or culture. And chess has too many factors. And now with internet, with these new technologies, networks, we have a very good chance of making chess a spectacular sport. We have a way to bring people into the interactive game and just help them to follow the event through very sophisticated technologies. Also, within the last few years, we are practicing or experimenting with so-called speed chess. It's the game where every opponent has only 25 minutes to complete his moves. And that's a very good televised version of chess. And the speed chess circuit was very successful in some major cities.
Garry Kasparov, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
World chess champion Garry Kasparov has a new talking chess game called Talking Coach. Coming up, golf with John Updike. This is Fresh Air. The pleasures of golf, like the pleasures of chess, tend to elude those who don't play. But for players, golf is often more than a pastime. It's an obsession. Take John Updike. He's such an excellent and prolific writer, you'd think he'd have no time left over for 18 holes. But golf is a longtime passion. Of course, he'll never come close to winning the golf equivalent of the honors he's won for his writing, like the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. He's written about golf in essays and in his novels. Now those writings on golf are collected in his new book, Golf Dreams. Here's a short reading from the preface, which he wrote last summer, a summer when his golf game was suffering, putting him in a gloomy mood.
The suspicion crept over me that golf had stolen my life away, the hard gem-like flame with which I, as an artist, should have burned, had been dampened, if not doused, by the green mists of this narcotic pastime, the fine edge that other penmen had dulled with whiskey and doses of Hollywood, I had let rust into dullness while wool-gathering over pronation and weight shift, wrist cock and knee bend.
Did golf seem like too tame and middle-class a pursuit for an impassioned artist?
Well, it is. You do meet people who don't read your books, and maybe that's a very healthy thing for a writer.
Really?
And it's a good insight into how, what should we call them, average Americans, middle Americans, normal Americans spend their time. And there's spend their pastime is this time-wasting recreation. I think it's been good for me to get away from writing and writers occasionally and be out there with a set of men, usually, who don't have much in common except the love of this game.
I feel like I've seen golf go from the square dad sport to a hip sport where rock stars are playing it, retired basketball stars are playing it, sports writers write books about Zen and golf. What changed?
I don't know. I'm told that tennis began to fade somehow. Tennis became uncool. And so the people looking for a cool sport turned to golf. I think Michael Jordan, in particular, his often professed love of the game, and Larry Bird, a number of basketball players seemed to take it up and would appear on these pro-ams and so on. All that certainly helped with the younger set, and I suspect the emergence of Tiger Woods will also attract a lot of people to the game who wouldn't ordinarily have played it. But in some way, yes, you're right. It has emerged from the country club, from being something played by old power brokers, old wasps, into a game that kind of all of America might enjoy, potentially.
Now, you're an extraordinary writer. Are you like a very good golfer or decent? Does it matter to you if you golf well or not? Does your enjoyment of the game depend on being good or being perceived by others as being good?
I think I'm a fairly competitive person who's tried to keep his golf in perspective. But I have played in little club tournaments where I really couldn't sleep at night rehearsing my bad shots, and I really felt humiliated in quite a profound way. And it's not as if I'm a pro and needs to make my living. As you say, I'm a writer professionally. But yeah, there have been times when I really hated my golf so much that I wondered if it was really worth it to keep on with this, because I was losing sleep over it. And normally I just try to play with a bunch of guys who aren't much better than me, or if they are better, forgive me for it. It should be something I don't take too seriously, so I've tried not to take it too seriously.
What's some of the most elliptical advice or just absurd advice you've been given on your game?
Well, golf advice is sort of hard to understand. People are always telling me don't hit from the top. And it took me years to get a glimmering of what this meant. And they also talk about casting your hands. Both those things, by the way, describe the condition of trying to begin the swing too soon. You must let the swing happen where it wants to, that is, at the bottom of the swing, where the ball is, and not begin at the top with a great burst of energy that by the time you get to the ball, the swing has already kind of spent its force. There's also quite a lot of golf talk about hips, and not just one hip, but the left hip versus the right hip. Knees. I've never been able to really assimilate information about knees, except that they should remain a bit bent. But most of my thought has been devoted, if you care, to the right elbow and the left heel. The right elbow should remain close to the body, and the left heel should be planted when you begin your swing. Both these sound simple enough, but they're very hard for me to do.
Have you read a lot of golf advice books, and I wonder what you've thought of the writing in those books?
I've read, I'd say, my share, but maybe not as many as some men have. The writing, they try to be clear, but it's a little like the instructions you get with a computer. Somehow the people aren't thinking quite in English.
Exactly, right.
And there's some other language intervening here, a language of body language or the computer language, but in some way, it's hard. It's hard the way that math is for some people. Some people in high school just can't get it. They can't get math. Others can. Golf books take a lot of patience, and you really ought to have a club in hand and read them outdoors and be able to put into practice what they're just said to you. Otherwise, it's all kind of anatomical gobbledygook.
Now, did you think of yourself as an athlete, or had you excelled in any sports before or really enjoyed any sports before?
I was sort of between being a useless geek and a real athlete. I couldn't make high school teams, but on the other hand, I wasn't totally boneless either. I did used to enjoy a lot of sort of pickup games of basketball and vacant lot baseball and vacant lot touch football and even tackle football. So I enjoyed athletics without being very good at them, and golf seemed to me possibly is metal enough that my brain could help my body become good at it, and hasn't quite worked out that way, but at least that was the thought. And it has kept me using my muscles and given me a kind of athletic fellowship into my sunset years, let's call them.
You know, when you golf, do you drive around in one of those little golf carts?
I have been known to do that, and I will do it if my playing partners want to, but I myself prefer to walk. I think it's healthier for you, obviously, and also it kind of gets you into the game. It makes you one with the course to walk it and to carry your bag. So I try to avoid the cart if I can.
So you carry your own bags when you walk?
I do. I don't carry very many. I carry a full set of clubs, but only two wood. So it's not terribly heavy. And I think, again, it's better for you. And there's a kind of an intimacy with your clubs that's nice. If you drag them behind you in a cart, your clubs are apt to feel sort of second rate, like the Duke of Edinburgh following the Queen. Whereas if you have the clubs on your back, they feel one with you, real help meets, and it makes you play better.
You have a very interesting and pretty funny essay called The Trouble with a Caddy, in which you talk about why you don't like to use caddies when you're playing golf. Let me ask you to read an excerpt of that.
I want to be alone with my golf. I don't mind my partner and opponents being there. Without them, there is no game, just practice. But to have a couple of youthful, usually strangers, also in attendance, turns the game into a mob sport. My golf is so delicate, so tenuously wired together with silent inward prayers, exhortations, and unstable visualizations, that the sheer pressure of an additional pair of eyes crumples the whole rickety structure into rubble. What is the caddy thinking? Keeps running through my mind, to the exclusion of all else, and how he must hate me. Or perhaps with that last foozled three wood, I have passed into a netherworld beneath his contempt. My wish to please the fellow, or at least to stop sending him on futile searches into the woods and the wild raspberry thickets, where the toxins of poison ivy and lime tick disease assault his bare shins, becomes obsessive and counterproductive one of golf's magic maxims being that the harder you try, the worse you play.
So when did you stop using caddies?
Again, it's like the cart. If they're forced upon me, I have to do it. I mean, right. I can't be a rugged individualist and scorn the caddy when he's there and he's come out of his house, stopped watching TV for an afternoon and wants to be hired. I occasionally do use a caddy, and they kind of unnerve me, although the younger they are and the more silent, the less they unnerve me. And the best caddy I ever had was a female. She was a solid 14-year-old girl who obviously was thinking of something else throughout the round, but would hand me the club if I asked. And I did not feel she was intruding into my golf privacy.
You compare your feelings about caddies with the discomfort that you and most Americans feel about servants. And then you write, I think this is very funny, you write, imagine writing a poem with a sweating, worried-looking boy handing you a different pencil at the end of every word. This is such a great comparison, such a really absurd comparison.
I'm glad you liked it. It just came to me in a flash. It's a little like Bill Clinton signing a bill, isn't it? Having a different pen at the end of every word. But, yeah, I've never been able to totally ignore the caddy, and I think it's what makes Americans uncomfortable, some Americans, most Americans, let's say, with servants, is that you tend to see them in our democratic fashion as people, not just artifacts set there for your service, but people with their own problems, their own thoughts, their own souls. So that when I'm playing with a caddy, I perhaps over-dramatize his or her stream of consciousness, frustrations with me, disappointment with me, anger with me, and it makes the game harder to play.
In your best-known books, the Rabbit series, Rabbit becomes a golfer. Why did you make him into a golfer? When and how did you decide to do that?
Well, a little game of golf figures in the spiritual search of the very first book, Rabbit Run. The clergyman who's trying to rein him in and bring him back to his wife, one tactic he uses is to offer him to play a game of golf. And Rabbit had caddied, evidently, or so I write. And so he wasn't totally unfamiliar to the game, and he got out there with the clergyman, and he was terrible, of course, being a beginner, basically. But he did hit one shot that was magical. And the passage winds up, this was it, or this is it, meaning he'd kind of found something absolute and pure that answers his own quest for this sort of purity. And so it seemed inevitable, really, that as he ages and rises in the social scale a bit, that he would join a club that has golf and play it. He's an ex-athlete, and athletes always need a game to play. And so it became part of the older Rabbit very much. And a number of his rounds are included in my book, Golf Dreams.
In the last Rabbit book, Rabbit at Rest, Rabbit retires in Florida at a condominium that has a golf course on the premises, and the course is surrounded by the homes, by the actual condominium homes. Have you ever golfed in those kind of Florida condominium golf courses? And I wonder how you find the experience having been used to either public courses or, private club courses.
Well, it's different. I have done it occasionally. I have friends who are in such a complex, such a compound, and who invited me to play. I wouldn't have written about it if I hadn't had a little experience. But it's a little disconcerting, basically, to know that you could slice this into somebody's front porch and to see people bringing in groceries and slamming car doors and doing the household duties we all do sort of within a stone's throw of you or a golf ball's throw of you. I don't think it's an ideal way to build a golf course, but it seems to be the only way you can do it and make money is when you have that, when you've invested in that much land, you thread the golf course between these homes that you sell off. It's not ideal, but then life isn't ideal, then it may be the best way for the Florida investors to deliver ever more golf courses to the hordes of people who go down there expecting to retire and play golf every day.
So many people seem to be finding this almost mystical aspect to the game of golf, comparing it to Zen or to, other religions, or talking about the inner focus that it brings. Did you always feel about that game, or is that some? Did you always feel that way about the game, or is it something that came?
I always felt there was something mysterious and mystical about it. I don't want to overdo this, and it can be overdone. But the swing is so quick, and in a sense invisible, that you can have success only by kind of letting go at a certain point and letting the club, as they say, do the work. And most of our bad golf, or much of our bad golf, is we try to over-control the club head. So yes, it's mystical. It's a Zen sport to the extent that if you do what feels wrong, but let go blank, whatever you call it, the results show you're on the right track. I haven't described that terribly well, but at the core of the golf swing, there is a kind of nothingness. And to swing it right, you got to accept that nothingness, even court that nothingness.
John Updike's new book is called Golf Dreams, Writings on Golf.
Just had a lesson and I'm really psyched. This game is easy if you do it right. I got the perfect tips on how to hit the ball. Now all I have to do is remember them all. Come on.
Imagine you're inside a great big wheel.
Okay, in the wheel.
Play the ball off of your front heel.
All right, yeah, right on the heel there.
Place your feet about a shoulder's width apart.
Yeah, right, easy shoulders,
Put
huh?
Put your knees and arch your back before you start.
Arch here, okay,
yeah. Lean your way towards the balls of your feet.
Yeah, a little bit forward.
Pretend that you're about to take a seat.
Okay, in the chair
Make
there.
Make sure your grip is not too tight.
Yeah, easy.
With the bottom of the feet just sliding to the right.
That sure was easy, now I'm on my way. I feel a little awkward, hey, but that's okay. I got my stance and I remembered everything. And now I'm ready for a real smooth swing. Okay.
Take the club back, low and slow.
All right, nice and easy, yeah.
Don't break your wrist until I have to
okay,
go.
Right there.
Peter Shoemaker from the CD Golf's Greatest Hits. Coming up, a review of Margaret Atwood's new novel. This is Fresh Air. In her four-decade-long writing career, Margaret Atwood has written over 30 books, including volumes of poetry, nonfiction, children's books, and science fiction. But her new novel, Alias Grace, which was published in Canada earlier this year and shortlisted for the Booker Prize, is her first work of true crime fiction. Book critic Maureen Carrigan hopes that it doesn't take Atwood four more decades to write another.
There's a scene early in Margaret Atwood's new novel, Alias Grace, in which a character enters the drawing room of a middle-class house and remarks to himself, "All possible surfaces of the room are upholstered. The colors are those of the inside of the body, the maroon of kidneys, the reddish-purple of hearts, the opaque blue of veins, the ivory of teeth and bones." That description gives you a sense of the spooky atmosphere of Alias Grace. The Victorian world it conjures up is more indebted to the influence of Bram Stoker than Louisa May Alcott, which is appropriate since Alias Grace recounts a real-life double murder case that horrified Canada in the last century. The facts upon which Atwood's sinister showpiece of a novel rests are these. In 1843, a 16-year-old Irish servant girl named Grace Marks was sentenced to death for the murders of her employer and his housekeeper mistress. Grace's motive was said to be jealousy, but her lawyer convinced the court she was insane. Her alleged accomplice was hanged, while Grace spent the next 30 years of her life in a lunatic asylum and then a penitentiary. She was eventually pardoned and moved to upstate New York, where she disappeared into the mists of history. Some chroniclers see Grace as a fiend, others as a victim of misogyny and anti-Irish prejudice. To still others, including Atwood, Grace Marks is an enigma, the Canadian soul sister of Lizzie Borden. Atwood has been haunted by Grace's story for decades. Back in 1974, she wrote a play for Canadian television based on the case. In Alias Grace, Atwood behaves like a modern-day Penelope, picking apart the neat chronological accounts woven by Grace's lawyer and 19th century reporters, and instead allowing the separate strands of the mystery to snake about in winding patterns. Atwood musters a host of different narrators and narrative methods here, letters, poems, newspaper clippings, but at the center of her novel is a fictional series of meetings between the imprisoned Grace and a Dr. Simon Jordan. Jordan has been hired by a church committee lobbying for Grace's release to try to prove her innocence by attempting to dispel her amnesia about the day of the murders. Rejecting mesmerism, magnets, bleeding, and other quack cures of the day, Jordan practices a rudimentary form of talk therapy, trying through artful conversation to restore Grace's memory, if indeed it's really lost. Initially, Grace resists. Gradually, though, she relents and treats Jordan to a riveting tale of her grim childhood in Ireland, her passage to America on the immigrant ship she describes as a slum in motion, and the first household in which she worked as a servant, where she was befriended by another girl who died of a botched abortion. As Jordan sits scribbling notes, a disturbing thing happens. He becomes possessed by Grace's story, literally, so that his life begins to take on the shadowy moral coloration of hers. For poor panicked Dr. Jordan, the old adage, "Physician, heal thyself," becomes an urgent command. As you'd expect from a writer with Atwood's distinguished track record, Alias Grace is much more than a vivid, faux-Victorian fictional restoration. This is a novel filled with images of walls that are easily breached, hinting at Atwood's larger preoccupation with the shifting boundaries between the powerful and the powerless, between sin and self-preservation, truth and lies. At the end of Alias Grace, Grace Marks's identity remains in doubt, but Atwood's reputation as a gifted, chameleon novelist is stunningly reaffirmed.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Margaret Atwood's new novel, Alias Grace. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Roberta Shurrock, with Tracy Tannenbaum and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Annie Bacon is our intern. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherie Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Glenn Close. She stars as Cruella de Vil in Disney's new version of 101 Dalmatians. I'm Cherie Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.